The book is called Strange Stars, David Bowie, Pop Music and the Decade Sci-Fi Exploded. Quite a colorful cover you've got on here, Jason, on this book. We're talking with Jason Heller, the author of the book. He's an award-winning, Hugo Award-winning author, also music journalist. So you kind of combine a little bit of that sci-fi fantasy with your love for music, I suppose.
Yeah, that was exactly why I wanted to write Strange Stars. It was just the two things I was most passionate about, science fiction and music. And so naturally, I was looking for a way that I could combine those in a book. And then I started thinking, well, you know, in the 70s, there was an explosion of music that was influenced by science fiction, pretty much led by David Bowie. So why don't I write about that?
Jason, I remember when I bought that album, when it came out, and I was fascinated by the album artwork, and then the sound of the record. I had never heard nor seen anything like that, and I thought, could this be the future of rock and roll? Kind of like space-age rock and roll. I even thought that when the album came out.
That's exactly what a lot of the science fiction-influenced musicians of the 70s had in mind. You know, David Bowie, when he did Space Oddity in 1969, it coincided with the Apollo 11 moon landing. It was actually sort of supposed to be a little bit of a novelty record that would piggyback on it, but it took on a life of its own as, you know, humans on Earth just became more and more fascinated with the idea of traveling into space, and it became more of a reality. So a lot of these musicians really were thinking about how will rock music or funk music or disco or jazz, what will it look like in the future, and can we make that right now in the 70s?
Did it leave some musicians behind because we were coming off of sort of like Summer of Love, Peace, acoustic, kind of very earthy, I guess, sounding music, and here you are trying to project something out of this world?
Yeah, that was exactly the transition that was happening. Science fiction did start to kind of seep into the counterculture a bit, the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s. It became kind of cool to be into science fiction, but it really did fly in the face of that kind of back to nature, kind of 60s hippie ideal. But there were people that made that transition really well. Paul Kantner from Jefferson Airplane is someone who is obsessed with science fiction. And he wrote tons of science fiction songs, both for Jefferson Airplane and for Jefferson Starship, as you might imagine, and then in his solo work. And he doesn't get as much credit as, say, David Bowie does, but he was a really instrumental figure in that transition from the psychedelic era of the late 60s into the science fiction music era of the 70s.
The type of music that comes out of it, though, sometimes has a cold feel. You know, when you get into something from an acoustic sounding something to more electronic or something that has sort of computerization to it, it seems sometimes a soul is left behind. Do you find that, or is that kind of what the purpose of some of it is?
Yeah, it was. It was, in a way. I think a lot of artists, so the big thing that really that precipitated that was the use of the synthesizer, which grew and grew throughout the 70s to where at the end of the 70s, you have, of course, all these completely synthesizer-based bands, you know, with the new wave bands. You know, I write about, obviously, Devo and the Human League and Gary Numan, who we know in the States from his hit Cars, which came out a little bit later. But yeah, artists were definitely, especially towards the end of the 70s, people like Kraftwerk too, and David Bowie with some of his albums in the mid-70s, like Low, were trying to use this idea that the future might be this cold, sterile, kind of technologically oppressive place, and at the same time trying to criticize that, but also maybe trying to find beauty in it by using these kind of cold synthetic sounds instead of the more organic, you know, drums and distorted guitar sound or acoustic sound.
Jason, what were some of the movies that might have inspired these people?
Yeah, well, the big one was definitely 2001, A Space Odyssey. So when that came out in 1968, it obviously influenced David Bowie because he took the name Space Odyssey and tweaked it just a bit for Space Oddity, which came out in 1969. That was a huge, huge breakthrough for people because it was a way... Stanley Kubrick, when he made 2001 A Space Odyssey, he was using science fiction cinema in a way that no one had done before to really deeply probe some of these big philosophical existential questions that we have in a science fiction movie rather than just how do we beat back the alien who's trying to invade us. So that really expanded the scope of conceptually of what a lot of musicians wanted to do. You know, it even started with people like David Crosby, who's a huge science fiction fan, and in The Birds and in Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and his solo work, he would sneak that in from time to time as well. But that movie was a big one. Kubrick's other science fiction movie from that era, A Clockwork Orange, with its really dystopian view of the future, was really a big influence as well. And then, of course, the movies we think of from 70s science fiction, like Soylent Green and Logan's Run. But Star Wars, of course, when it came out in 1977, was a huge explosion. It was so mainstream and so popular that musicians hopped on the bandwagon making Star Wars-inspired music.
Did the music movement kind of run out of gas, or has it run out of gas, or was it just a natural progression?
I think it was a natural progression. I think that the way science fiction influenced music in the 70s really paralleled what was happening not just in science fiction but in real-life technology. With the space program, its kind of ups and downs in the 70s as it became kind of controversial in the 70s. Why are we spending all these billions of dollars when we could be using that money here on Earth to help people? You know, there was that big debate really swirling around. And a lot of that confusion and doubt was reflected in a lot of the music that was being made. And I think that even in the 70s, you think about all the things that seemed like science fiction that were becoming commonplace all of a sudden. You know, things like home computers, you know, that are now being introduced to the market. And people were concerned, and those concerns about the future and the new role in technology in our lives was just being reflected in the music. The music was just like pop music does or rock music does. It just reflects what's going on in society at the time. So a lot of those fears kind of fell by the wayside a little bit as we got more used to technology. People stopped singing quite as much about science fiction.
We're talking today with Jason Heller. The book is called Strange Stars, David Bowie, Pop Music, and the Decade Sci-Fi Exploded. Did the passing of David Bowie maybe make you think differently or look back on this or maybe want to explore that era of his career?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was already working on this book when David Bowie died in January of 2016. David Bowie was the first concert I ever saw as a kid at the Glass Spider Tour in 1987. You know, I camped out for tickets with my buddy, and we went down seventh row and had our minds blown. So David Bowie was always going to be a really central figure to the book, and then when he died while I was writing it, it really kind of lit a fire under me, I think. I wanted to make a portrait. Among the other things I wanted Strange Stars to do is I wanted to make this portrait of David Bowie as a science fiction fan and a creator of science fiction. And that portrait hadn't really been made yet. And so I just wanted to show this different angle of him among all the different angles that were being portrayed in the wake of his death.
How does science fiction meld with disco? I mean, it beautifully, if you ask Miko, I guess. What did that do for it? What other musicians there maybe, or sometimes with progressive rock, there's maybe a pompous to it, or maybe a sort of a special reverence that doesn't need to be there. What did that kind of do to the two types of artists, I guess, in that genre?
Right. So science fiction disco erupted in 1977 because the two hottest things on the planet in 1977 were Star Wars and disco, because Saturday Night Fever came out that same year. So naturally, people like Miko, the disco producer, combined John Williams' orchestral theme for Star Wars with disco and had a huge hit with it. And then that spawned tons of people who did similar things. Everyone from Earth, Wind, and Fire to Sarah Brightman, who would later go on to be, you know, a huge star of the stage. A lot of these people hopped on the bandwagon, and some of the music is really fun. Some of the science fiction disco, some of it's ridiculous, but it really showed the big change that had happened. You mentioned the progressive rock bands who were bigger in the early 70s, right? So we think like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and Yes, and King Crimson. And those bands took science fiction very, when they did incorporate it into their lyrics, which wasn't always, but when they did, they took it very seriously. And then the most of the space disco or science fiction disco groups and artists were just having fun. It was just pure glitz. It was, let's just celebrate and glam this up and be ridiculous with it. But it really served its purpose as well. And it really did, again, reflect the fact that Star Wars had made science fiction something fun and eye-popping and really accessible to people, whereas sometimes before people viewed it as something very self-serious or kind of cult-like, you know, to be into science fiction.
Science fiction always has, you know, it's good and evil that exists in science fiction. How do you kind of stack any artists maybe in those categories, or if there is such a thing for those?
Right. No, that's science fiction has always battled with the big issues of morality. One of the great things about science fiction is that it can cast that tension between good and evil on a far vaster scale than any other type of fiction. And then it can also toy with the ambiguity between the two. You know, you think about the Force in Star Wars, right? There's the two sides of it. And, you know, with most of the music that was being made that was influenced by science fiction in the 70s really tried to... It didn't really seem to take sides as much. If there was any kind of morality really being explored, it was along the lines of, say, what George Orwell was exploring in 1984. And, of course, 1984 was a huge influence on many science fiction musicians, including David Bowie. His album, Diamond Dogs, originally began as an adaptation of George Orwell's 1984, but George Orwell's widow denied him the permission, so he had to tweak some of the details, but he still kind of kept the basic idea of 1984, and he even snuck in a song called 1984 and a song called Big Brother on Diamond Dogs as kind of a tribute to George Orwell and the influence that he had on him.
Did you find some new favorites as far as music during this book and the research?
I did. So I thought I knew most of the artists that I would be covering, and the more I researched, the more I dug in. One of the favorites I found was this gentleman named Julian J. Savarin, who in the early 70s had a band called Julian's Treatment, and he was a British artist, and he made these remarkable concept albums about science fiction. He drew a lot from Isaac Asimov's science fiction novels, and it was just this really beautiful, amazing, and very deeply conceptual, very committed to science fiction type of music. And of course, it flopped miserably. It was not a hit in any way. And then what was the most intriguing thing to me about this guy, Julian J. Savarin, is after trying to make science fiction albums, these vast concept albums, and kind of failing at it, he decided, well, I'm just going to do away with the music part of it, and he became a novelist. He became a science fiction novelist, apparently figuring that that would be a whole lot easier than trying to tell these science fiction stories through music.
Did the computerization, keyboard, that electronic stuff sometimes ever get in the way? I think sometimes if you have a piece of equipment, you feel as though you need to use every button on it.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, when synthesizers especially were coming into use in the early 70s by most of the progressive rock bands, they were vast and complicated machines that you really had to have some technical know-how to operate. You couldn't just do like the Casio that we're familiar with, just, you know, go up and start tapping the keys and pressing the buttons. You really had to know the guts of this. You had to patch through all these complicated things to try to discover the sounds that you wanted. And yes, definitely a lot of the musicians who explored science fiction in the early 70s through synthesizers kind of got swallowed up in that. And that really is another stark difference between the beginning of the 70s and the end of the 70s, because at the end of the 70s, synthesizers were becoming cheap, compact, really easy to use, and so almost anyone could get their hands on one and use one very easily. And so that's where you start to get what we know as the sound of the 80s, that kind of synth pop sound, you know, with bands like Soft Cell and that was really, really the big shift in technology musically that made it a whole lot easier for people who wanted to have futuristic sounds in their music to be able to express those.
I remember when the drum machine first showed up, people thought it was the end of the drummer, and it would be kind of, that's where everything, maybe sometimes we always take a giant leap forward when we hear something, we think, okay, electronic sound, that's how it's all going to be. Obviously, grunge came by to show us that it was a different way at that particular point. But do you, I guess, did the sausage come out okay from the beginning of the 70s to the end and where we are today with that?
I think it did. I think that's a great point. You know, whenever there's a new novel way of doing things, and not just with musical technology, right? This is just civilization, especially, you know, since we've really accelerated the pace of technology over the last 100 years or so. We'll get some new toy or some new way of doing something, and we'll go overboard on it. And that's what a lot of the science fiction musicians in the 70s did. They had all these new tools, and they just went nuts. And the sound that was produced, to some ears, may sound ridiculous or dated or cheesy, but to other ears, and hopefully after reading Strange Stars, people can hear that music in maybe a kind of a different light. You can hear what is kind of underlying that, this kind of joy of creation, of using new technology, of wanting to tell stories about the future and about our place in a technological world. I mean, these are all things that are still relevant to us, even if the music that some of these musicians made may sound a little out of date at this point.
Well, Jason, I remember as a college DJ back in those days, I played a lot of the music you write about in your book. And one thing that stood out for me was how adventurous it seemed to be and how you heard a whole lot of new sounds with the Mellotron and the synthesizers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was really part of a really core part of the mission that these people had. You know, I talk a lot in the book about a band that not as many people in the United States know called Hawkwind. And Hawkwind, of course, were this British band, and a lot of people do know them from their bass player, Lemmy, who, of course, went on to form Motorhead, the late Lemmy. And Hawkwind were this group of hippies who were basically anarchists and lived in squats in London and made this super repetitive, futuristic, really crude kind of music, but with tons of synthesizers on it that made it sound futuristic. It was like this future primitivism. And it was, to me, Hawkwind are like a great example of how technology was being used and new sounds were being used to really show the contrast between the present and the future, or the past and the future. You know, they deliberately wanted to have really primitive sounds with very futuristic synthesizers on top of them, almost tribal sounds with synthesizers on top. Because in a way, that's how we we felt and how we sometimes still feel. Like, you know, we're not that much more advanced in a lot of ways than cavemen, and here we are with these tools to go to the stars.
I found it interesting, too, that it crossed over all genres, you know.
Oh, yeah, all genres of music.
Was able to...
people automatically will think of rock music, especially progressive rock, like Rush and so forth, when they think of science fiction music. But there were just as many jazz artists, funk artists, you know, George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic, The Undisputed Truth, LaBelle, a lot of African-American groups were exploring, you know, what became known as Afrofuturism in music in the 70s. And so, yeah, I even have a little bit in the book about science fiction reggae in the 70s. So it really did span all genres of music.
Does it still vibrate somewhere today? Somewhere? Do you find a core of it or a thread of it still existing?
There's actually a lot of musicians these days who are doing science fiction-influenced music. I mean, science fiction is bigger than it's ever been, right? Almost all the blockbusters, if you count like the superhero movies, are science fiction to some degree. It's really become just a part of the cultural backdrop. You would expect there to be more musicians maybe tapping into science fiction these days. But there are a lot of them, but they're not necessarily as popular. But, you know, we do have Janelle Monáe, the R&B artist, who just had a new album come out recently. And she's been really at the forefront of popularizing or repopularizing the idea that popular music can express futurism and science fiction. She even had a science fiction concept album a few years back. So, you know, I could see how it could become a big thing again. But then again, in the 70s, it was kind of big briefly. Most of it was underground music. You know, you did have people like David Bowie who would kind of pop up and become popular doing this. But there's a similarity now to then, which I think that if you want to explore something deeply science fictional, these really big ideas in music, you're probably going to have a pretty specific audience for that.
Right. Well, I was thinking in recent radio time, and this is probably going back in the last 5 years, that Nicki Minaj had Starships, whatever these songs are about, I really don't know. And then you've got like Katy Perry with her Alien, you know, Alien Encounter or whatever. So there are some people that still kind of explore it in
oh, absolutely. And a lot of times it is more like in the videos, kind of how it was in the 80s. So, you know, in the 80s it became ubiquitous that there was science fiction imagery like everywhere because it's flashy and attention-grabbing. MTV was the new normal. And so, you know, we definitely still do see a lot of artists kind of dipping into that a little bit. But it's kind of similar to what the science fiction disco artists were doing as well, where it was not something that most songwriters or singers are really digging into that deeply. With Janelle Monáe, who I just mentioned, kind of being one of the big examples of someone who really does seem steeped in science fiction.
Well, as you have on the cover of the book with David Bowie, nobody like him who could transform himself in a blink of an eye, really immerse himself into a character, and we'd believe he is who he says he is at that moment. We can appreciate that and how you've put him into this book, Strange Stars, David Bowie, Pop Music and the Decade Sci-Fi Exploded. Our guest this morning has been Jason Heller. Jason, if people want to find out more about this book or you or any of this music, where's a good place to get some of those?
My publisher is really a good place to go, Melville House. They have a great blog that I write for, and they're really on the ball with helping me spread the word about this music in this book.
And of course, online now, if you have the title of a song or an artist, you put that into a search. There's somebody out there who decided to upload the audio for that particular song, no matter how obscure it might be. That's for sure.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? That's one of the fun things I've been hearing from people who've been reading the book so far, is there are so many songs mentioned, and a lot of them they haven't heard of, and so they'll just be looking them up online and listening to them for the very first time while they're reading about them in the book. And that apparently is, from what I hear, is really one of the joys of reading this for the first time.
Right, except for the 7-minute version of Empire Strikes Back by Miko. Until I get to this laser sounding or Chewbacca, I mean, mean, that's the part I'm waiting for. Some of the oddball drive. I mean, it's taking, you know, it's taking the Beatles and George Martin and their weird sound effects to an extreme level.
Absolutely. Oh, there's plenty of excess to be found in some of these songs, no doubt. That's part of the fun.
Absolutely. Well, it's fun talking with you, Jason. We appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much.
Thank you.